The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Hunter Biden agrees to a plea deal that could leave him free of prison time. Speaker of the House, Kevin McCarthy.
If you are the president's son, you get a sweetheart deal.
We'll take a closer look with Andrew Klavan.
It gets so corrupt that there's a kind of boldness and an almost a sense of humor about their corruption comes out, where they're almost laughing at you, saying, what are you going to do? How are you going to stop us?
Plus, Secretary of State Blinken visits China.
We do not support Taiwan independence. We remain opposed to any unilateral changes to the status quo by either side.
We'll take a look with Gordon Chang.
It showed and displayed weakness, which Tony Blinken is an excellent guy at doing.
And Brandon Weikert.
I think that Blinken's statement was basically a green light, at least that's how it's being taken in China, to basically hit Taiwan because they don't think Biden will do anything to stop them.
All this and more. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my radio program each weekday morning live, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern Time and on demand 24/7. Learn more at HughHewitt.com. Follow me, please, on Twitter, at Hugh Hewitt. Follow this program as well at Town Hall Review. We'll begin in Delaware. In the announcement this past week from U.S. Attorney David Weiss that a plea agreement had been reached in principle with Hunter Biden, the president's son, the deal must first be approved by a federal judge. If it is approved, reports indicate that Hunter will avoid any time in prison. Speaker of the House Kevin McCarthy responded.
If you were the president's leading political opponent, the DOJ tries to literally put you in jail and give you prison time. If you are the president's son, you get a sweetheart deal.
He's right. Of course it's a sweetheart deal. Of course people with similar convictions and pleas go to jail, sometimes for a long time. And Hunter Biden's going to escape. We'll turn to Andrew Klavan, best-selling author, now a podcaster and cultural commentator. He was a guest of my friend Larry O'Connor on the Salem News Channel.
And I know, listen, it's not like conservatives to scream, that's not fair, right? I mean, we all know life's not fair. Who told you life was fair? But there are some things in our society that do need to be fair, aren't
well,
there?
Yes. Well, yeah. I mean, when conservatives say life is not fair, they mean that literally life is not fair. People get sick and die. People die young. People die old. You know, it's like things happen to us that just don't work out. And there are also parts of human nature that aren't fair and that we can't do anything about. But of course, we can try to be fair. That is the whole point of being a human being, is to humanize the world. And one of the ways we are fair is by treating everybody equally under the law. The left has really come up with a new theory about this. Aside from their corruption, which is also quite deep, they also have a theory that people should be treated according to how much power they have in a sort of fake fantasy intersectional chart that has been made up in academia. So if you are a black person, you've been treated unfairly as a group, and therefore you can commit crimes and get off easy. Whereas if you're a white cop who shoots somebody in self-defense, you're guilty per se, you're guilty before you even face trial.
Yeah.
But what's happening at this top level, where Donald Trump maybe fairly is being charged for something that Hillary Clinton did almost the same thing and was not only not charged, you have to remember that James Comey said the reason he wasn't charging her was because he couldn't prove intent. This was after, as you say, she bleached and hammered her phones to destroy the evidence. I thought intent was written all over this. Whereas Donald Trump, when you read the indictment, they can't even name what his motive is because the guy is so chaotic and scattershot in his thinking that we don't even know what he was thinking when he withheld these documents and whether the documents should have been withheld or not. So it's very complicated. It's just not right that he should be charged when she wasn't, especially when he's in position to run. And now with this Hunter Biden thing, I mean, this is the kind of thing that you see in advanced states of corruption. When you have like a Boss Tweed New York or 1980s New York or places like Chicago, New Orleans, the Illinois state government, it gets so corrupt that there a kind of boldness and an almost a sense of humor about their corruption
yes.
comes out, where they're almost laughing at you, saying, what are you going to do? How are you going to stop us? And of course, with the Department of Justice, it's a good question. How are we? Who is going to charge the Department of Justice with a crime? Nobody, basically.
Yeah.
And to charge Hunter Biden, to say, well, he didn't pay the right taxes on the $1.5 million he made for 2 years. First of all, that leaves out the $5 million in bribes he was channeling to his father. And took by himself. So somehow that got washed aside. The stuff that has reached the press, the legitimate stuff from his laptop that has reached the press, is enough to make you feel that something very, very terrible has happened at the top levels of our government through the auspices of Joe Biden and his family. And that they could investigate this. I think it's 5 years they've been investigating this mm-hmm. and come out with, you know, tax evasion and a gun charge where he gets no jail time. I'm surprised they left off the littering charges and the bad parking charges and maybe an overdue library book that he may have forgot to return. You know, this is the kind of corruption that is late level corruption. It's usually just before the fall that this sort of pride and outspoken and humorous corruption occurs.
The news of the Hunter Biden plea deal comes, of course, on a week where we're learning more about the Russia collusion hoax, and I mean hoax with a capital H, from Special Counsel John Durham. And as the Biden administration's posture towards China has come under increasing scrutiny. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken was in China on Monday, meeting with President Xi Jinping. Speaking to the press from the U.S. Embassy in Beijing, Blinken's statement has raised eyebrows.
On Taiwan, I reiterated the longstanding U.S. one-China policy. That policy has not changed. It's guided by the Taiwan Relations Act, the three joint communiques, the six assurances. We do not support Taiwan independence. We remain opposed to any unilateral changes to the status quo by either side. We continue to expect the peaceful resolution of cross-strait differences. We remain committed to meeting our responsibilities under the Taiwan Relations Act, including making sure that Taiwan has the ability to defend itself.
China expert Gordon Chang was a guest of Sebastian Gorka.
It's strange. We do not support Taiwan independence. Doesn't Taiwan function as an independent nation? I'm a bit confused, Gordon.
Yes, I'm a bit confused, too. You know, what Tony Blinken did was he announced and went through the three bases of our Taiwan policy. You heard them there. And I'm glad he included the six assurances from President Reagan's time, because the State Department about a week ago did not include them. And those are the most pro-Taiwan of the three things that he mentioned, the Taiwan Relations Act and the three communiques. So it was good that he mentioned six assurances. But I don't think that he should have said that we do not support Taiwan independence. Now, it is true that we don't. But the point is that after considering what it went on in Beijing, he should not have said something which was very pro-China, largely because it showed and displayed weakness, which Tony Blinken is an excellent guy at doing. So that was not the right thing to say at that particular time.
Isn't the point with regards to Taiwan that we profess strategic ambiguity?
Yes, we do have the policy of strategic ambiguity, which is not to tell either Taipei or Beijing what we would do in the case of imminent conflict. I believe that we should no longer have that policy. We should move to strategic clarity. Now, strategic ambiguity has obviously kept the peace for three decades, but that was a benign period, Seb, and we're no longer in a benign period because, as Henry Kissinger said just a couple days ago, that war with China is more likely than not. And for once in his life, Henry Kissinger is correct. We are very close to war. So that's one of the other reasons why I would not have said, as Tony Blinken did, that we do not support Taiwan independence.
I'm glad you said that about Dr. Kissinger, a man who affected the rise of China and convinced Nixon that, don't worry about it. We'll open to Beijing and everything will be fine. Yeah, right. Thank you, Dr. Kissinger. So if we put this comment into correct context, walk us through this in a red teaming exercise. If China, as we have seen in the last 2 weeks, not only flies across the flight path in one of its jets, of one of our military aircraft, not up beside it and winks like in Top Gun, but actually traverses the trajectory of our aircraft very dangerously. Or if we see in the Straits a Chinese warship come very, very close to one of our vessels, if that occurs, and then we have this response about no independence for Taiwan, given that provocation, how is that read by the head of the People's Liberation Army, by General Lee? How is it interpreted by Xi Jinping and his inner circle of advisors?
Yeah, that's the problem, because they'll interpret it as the United States showing submission to Beijing. And Blinken already did that in a number of different ways. Even before the trip was formally announced, China was delivering slight upon slight to the Secretary of State. I mean, he should not have gone in the first place, given what China was doing. And it gets a little bit weedy when you start talking about some of the diplomatic technicalities. But this was a trip where China wanted to show the world that the U.S. acknowledged its submission to the grandeur of the Celestial Court. And unfortunately, we're going to see that played again and again by China over the coming months.
And if that is the case, if they not only can provide the appearance of our submission, but actual submission, what happens next time? Will they up the ante on their side when it comes to these engagements or close calls?
Yeah, I think that they certainly will do that. You know, you mentioned the dangerous intercepts. There was the intercept on May 26th of our RC-135 in international airspace over the South China Sea. May 26th was no accident, because 1 year before, China almost brought down an Australian P-8 reconnaissance plane, also in international airspace over the South China Sea. So the intercept on May 26th was a warning. And we have to remember that the Chinese take these anniversaries very, very seriously. Yeah. So we're Americans. We think that we're entitled to be oblivious to what the Chinese are doing.
You mentioned Australia, that has been struggling very seriously with Chinese penetration, even in the parliament there. They have very significantly increased their defense spending. They're going to have a 30% increase in the size of their armed forces. Can you talk to us about the rest of the region? How are they responding to Blinken's acquiescence?
Yeah, the two countries in the region that have really stepped up, one of them is Australia, as you just pointed out. The other is Japan, which in December of last year announced a 50% increase in their defense budget over the five-year period. I mean, they're buying U.S. Tomahawk missiles. They are developing indigenously hypersonic cruise missiles. So they're really moving very fast in Japanese terms. And that's a good thing, because Japan has generally been a laggard, but on China, it's become, I think, right now, more resolute than the Biden administration is. So that's good.
Coming up,
there are a whole bunch of measures in the Congress. All of them are being held up by the White House, so the Chinese will talk to us, right? We have to put on hold the challenge of China in order to ask China not to be challenging.
When the Town Hall Review returns in a moment.
As the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy celebrates our 25th anniversary year, please watch our new promotional video based on Ronald Reagan's 1976 radio address, Shaping the World for 100 Years to Come, on our Pepperdine SPP YouTube channel. And if you know someone who's thinking about graduate school this fall, we welcome applications at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. That's publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-702-5400. I'm here with spokesman John Wolfe. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-702-5400. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now, 800-702-5400.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. I have been trying to raise awareness on the China threat, first quietly, but then increasingly loud, and now at full volume for at least a half dozen years. The House leadership under Kevin McCarthy was the most significant win that came out of the 2020 election cycle because it meant one House of Congress could at least deal with China. But there are significant limits to what control of one chamber of Congress can deliver. We are dealing with a dangerous mood of appeasement from the Biden White House. James Carafano of the Heritage Foundation explains, once again, with Sebastian Gorka.
What is the epitome of Biden's leadership in the world is not where things go well because allies pull us into doing the right thing.
Right.
It's where Joe Biden does his own thing. And here we have China who's increasingly aggressive, and the Biden response to that is to increasingly plead with them, please talk to me.
Yeah, please,
so,
please will you talk to
me? So this is, not a lot of people know this. This is really important, really true. There are a whole bunch of measures, which bipartisan, Republican, Democrat, in the Congress, ban TikTok, you know, ban the land, you know, don't let the far outbound investment, you know.
Investigate to, COVID.
But, right.
Right, right.
All of them are being held up by the White House. For the, and here's why. So the Chinese will talk to us, right? So we have
just
to
talk.
No, you're right.
No concessions.
No.
Just actually pick up the phone.
We have to put on hold the challenge of China in order to ask China not to be challenging. Now, how well do you think this is going to work? Literally groveling with the Chinese because they're mad at us, right?
Because groveling with dictatorships always works.
Right, and essentially having to make concessions for the privilege of talking to the Chinese. So the useful idiot. That actually is Bill Gates' middle name, the useful idiot. The man who has amassed this great fortune and has squandered it in so many ways. He started a huge healthcare initiative, which actually in many parts of the world actually does as much harm as it does good. He backs this climate change scam, which actually impoverishes and hurts people all over the world. So what does he do? He goes there, right?
To China.
Right. As part of the American groveling experience, right? And here is China saying, oh, look at my great friend Bill Gates, you know, Americans, you know, what's wrong with the U.S. government? Why can't they be great friends like Bill? So even as American companies, as we speak, are pulling the plug on China right and left because of Chinese oppression and influence and meddling, right? Bill Gates is there being a poster child for Xi.
And they're both probably moaning about America. Bill Gates and Xi Jinping.
I wouldn't be surprised. Right. So could you see two greater contrasts of America and the world?
In the face of this posture of appeasement from the Biden administration, the Wall Street Journal reported this week, and I quote, China and Cuba are negotiating to establish a new joint military training facility on the island, sparking alarm in Washington that it could lead to the stationing of Chinese troops and other security and intelligence operations just 100 miles off Florida's coast. That's from the Wall Street Journal again. Brandon Weikert is a prolific writer who has been working hard to awaken the American people to the imminent threat from China. He was a guest of Andrew Wilkos on the Salem News Channel.
It's not enough that China is building a deep water port in Nicaragua. They are now building a military base in Cuba. You know, the island 90 miles from the southern tip of Florida where people are able to make it on rickety rafts. Yeah, that island is now going to have a Chinese military base. So the Monroe Doctrine is now out the window. But when it comes to China, the Biden administration seems to have no real policy and no real plan. They can't even get their answers straight on Taiwan.
Well, because we don't actually fully recognize that China owns Taiwan. We simply acknowledge that there's one system in China, and Taiwan is not an independent country, but it's not run every day by China's government. And that's caused the point of contention for many decades between us. The reason this exists, though, is because the Carter administration was desperate to get a deal with China, and they basically were going to let the Chinese think one thing, and the Chinese wanted the deal with us, so they were going to let us think one thing, hoping that none of this ever came to a head, which, of course, now it is, because we have President Biden in charge, who's the man who's not there. He has no real ability to control anything because, let's face it, he is not really in control of anything, including his own faculties.
In those two words, to say we acknowledge Taiwan's independence is to say we acknowledge they think they're independent, right? Right. Recognizing it would mean we agree with it.
Right, right. And of course, we don't fully agree with it because that would be the declaration of war. That would be a declaration of war that would force us to go to war for Taiwan with nuclear-armed China. So we're doing this weird kabuki dance, but we have a guy in charge of us who can't do this anymore. And so he, you know, he clearly wants to do a deal with China, but obviously he can't, and I don't think we should. But we have a very bad president right now who's taking us down a very dangerous path. And it's going to lead to a war. I think that Blinken's statement was basically a green light, at least that's how it's being taken in China, to basically hit Taiwan because they don't think Biden will do anything to stop them.
I mean, it probably would just be cheaper for them to just buy off the political class, right? I mean, you know, why waste the ammo and perhaps the troops when you could just funnel money into the island and buy elections?
Yeah, that's certainly part of their plan. But, you know, Xi Jinping right now, he's got some problems at home. So he might be looking for a foreign policy distraction. And if he thinks he can clobber the Americans because we have a horrible president, he might just go for broke here. And he might get lucky. You know, the history belongs to the bold. And, you know, but Xi's much bolder than our leader currently is.
The firewall of the Monroe Doctrine has come down clearly. And Biden seems to have no policy nor plan. And I don't know. I don't know that at this time China is going to stage up a military invasion of the United States. Certainly they want to use Cuba like a giant antenna to spy on us. But it would also give them a bargaining chip to say, well, we don't want you in the Straits of Taiwan anymore. Or we don't want you in North Korea anymore. Or we don't want you in the Philippines. As a matter of fact, we want you out of our backyard.
Yeah. That's probably what's going to happen or what they're angling for. But this is a very unstable and uncertain time, so you never know. Maybe they will go for something bigger. But I think you're onto something, that this is a reciprocal thing. They want to be able to basically say to us, you're in our backyard, we're going to be in your backyard. Of course, the problem is, if a war were to break out, having strategic bases in Cuba, as well as Venezuela and Nicaragua, like they are developing, gives them a lot of leverage over us. They could target the Panama Canal. They could cut us off from being able to easily move naval forces from the Atlantic to the Pacific. They could also go after trade. They can flood, as they are doing with fentanyl. They could flood our borders with fentanyl and drugs and even military-aged men, which is what they're doing right now, to maybe use as a fifth columnist attack force. And also, as you know, Cuba, they could use as a giant, not just eavesdropping outpost, but they might even be able to interfere with critical functions of our society electronically from those supposed listening posts in Cuba.
Wouldn't take much to hit us with an EMP from 90 miles away. Yeah. This wasn't happening under Donald Trump. This was not happening under Donald Trump.
No, and to be fair, it wasn't even really happening under Barack Obama, who was, until Biden, the worst president. You know, it's happening under Biden, which is shocking. You know, he was touted as this foreign policy guru. Well, his foreign policy experience seems to be in the glad-handing dictators in order to get money from them realm of affairs, rather than actually standing up for U.S. national interests. This has been one giant surrender tour, whether it's, you know, in Europe or in Asia or in Africa or Latin America. And this is just par for the course with him.
You can catch Andrew Wilkow, Larry O'Connor, and yours truly on the Salem News Channel at salemnewschannel.com via your Roku device. Coming up, our naval weakness.
Command of the seas is a bit like oxygen. You don't really appreciate it until it disappears.
China Select Committee Chair Mike Gallagher. When the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. Stay with us.
Hi, it's Mike Gallagher. I start every day by reading through the stories at Daybreak Insider. In just 10 minutes, I can zip through 10 stories that help me start my day and help shape where I go with the Mike Gallagher Show. Over 250,000 people get Daybreak Insider by email daily, and it's available to you at no cost. Go to daybreakinsider.com and simply plug in your email. That's daybreakinsider.com. In 5 minutes, you will be the most informed person in the office. That's daybreakinsider.com.
We Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. We look at the growing threat from China today, and I want to take a step back now and look into China's fast-growing naval strength. What caught my attention was an essay in The Atlantic by Jerry Kendricks, a PhD but also a retired Navy captain. The title of the article, The Age of American Naval Dominance is Over. The subtitle, The United States has ceded the ocean to its enemies. We can no longer take freedom of the seas for granted. I turned to Wisconsin Representative Mike Gallagher, chairman of the new Select Committee on the Chinese Communist Party. What did you make of the essay? What do you make of the threat?
Well, first on the essay, I thought it was fantastic. It's a must-read essay for anyone who cares about national security. And Jerry makes some core points that I think your listeners will be familiar with, but need to be said to a wider audience. One, command of the seas is a bit like oxygen. You don't really appreciate it until it disappears. And then you really wish you'd invested in maintaining it. Two, we need something akin to a ship's act that's just as aggressive, if not more, than the CHIPS Act that was just passed. And we really overall just need to have a sea power centric strategy to guide our Department of Defense efforts. We just played a war game that I led at the Republican conference. We did it on the first night, and I think it was illuminating for our members to see just how dire the situation is, how quickly we run out of ammo, and how much of a strategic liability our inability to rebuild the Navy is. And Jerry's essay, I think, captures that better than anything I've read in recent years. And so my hope is that our members, the Republican side, took away from that war game a sense that there are meaningful things we can do this Congress, start to replenish our stockpile of key munition system, like the long-range anti-ship missile, JASSM, and other SM-6 and other key missile systems. It was a very eye-opening experience, especially, I think, for those members who don't serve on national security committees.
Dr. Hendricks in the essay in The Atlantic says we're down to, you know, a dozen gravettes, the kind of piers that you need to build ships. Did anyone discuss that? And will you be holding a hearing for the Select Committee on the Chinese Communist Party on the People's Liberation Army Navy? Because their extraordinary expansion brings to mind what the Kaiser did prior to World War One. And the teaming up of Putin and Xi brings to mind the 30s.
It does. And, very quickly on Putin and Xi, because you asked at the outset, I mean, increasingly, we just have to see these two problem sets as connected. I think it would be geopolitical malpractice to try and isolate the problem with Russia and Putin from the problem of Xi Jinping and communist China, because obviously they're involved in a no limits partnership, what I've called a new Cold War against us. And the collapse of deterrence in one theater affects the stability of deterrence in another theater. Yes, there was discussion about how we rebuild our Navy. Representative Whitman had the first question from the audience and talked about our inability after those first 7 days, because we only did one move. We did 7 days. We didn't finish the war. All right, well, now we got to move a bunch of stuff, men and materiel, from the continental United States into the Indo-Pacific. How are we going to do that? We don't have the ability to do that. As for the 60 Minutes piece, I was honored to participate with former Representative Elaine Loria. And I really think that 60 Minutes did a great job highlighting an issue that sometimes doesn't get highlighted outside our sea power circles. You know, one thing I've disagreed with Admiral Gilday on is that he'll point to the shipbuilders, to the shipbuilding industrial base, and say, well, hey, you guys got workforce constraints, you got supply chain constraints, you're limited in terms of what you can do. Well, those companies will say to him, we don't have a demand signal coming from the Navy such that we could start to make multi-year investments in our workforce, in our supply chain. You know, let me just go back and hammer one final thing here. That multi-year procurement authority, the ability to have a pot of money that transcends the budget fight every year, at least for key munitions and missile systems, is absolutely essential. For $10 billion or less, I believe we could seriously enhance our deterrent posture and prevent World War III, at least over the next couple of years.
Yeah, Representative Gallagher, the only way to persuade the American people is layering. But I would like to see your select committee focus on the PLAN, because driving home to Americans that they have vastly expanded their fleet faster than any fleet in history is an important point. And I don't know that Americans really understand just how big the Russian and Chinese threat is, particularly the latter on the blue water.
Our really sort of main mission is to explain to the American people why any of this matters, why they should care that we are seeding command of the seas, to use Dr. Hendricks' phrase, to our enemies, and why, therefore, we in Congress should do something about it over the next 2 years. It's getting that sort of communication piece right that allows us to fuel our policy and legislative agenda. A lot of our early hearings, and we're hoping to finalize our whole year's plan here soon, are focused on the nature of the threat. We're trying to explain why this is such a threat, a clear and present danger to the American people. And then we're going to be transitioning to two things. One, I call the sprint, the things we can do in the 118th Congress, even though it's a divided Congress, to actually meaningfully improve our position. And then the long-term marathon, the things we need to do over the next 10 to 20 to 30 years to win the next century, to make sure we don't lose that long-term marathon or new Cold War or whatever your phrase in the moment is.
Coming up.
You know, the Chinese Navy has tripled essentially in the last 15 years.
When the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment.
As the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy celebrates our 25th anniversary year, please watch our new promotional video based on Ronald Reagan's 1976 radio address, Shaping the World for 100 Years to Come, on our Pepperdine SPP YouTube channel. And if you know someone who's thinking about graduate school this fall, we welcome applications at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. That's publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Weakness is provocative. That's a quote from the late Donald Rumsfeld. The Secretary of Defense from under both President Gerald Ford and President George W. Bush knew what he was talking about. That line should come to mind as we think about China, most immediately by our naval weakness and the aggressive investment we've seen from the CCP in their naval fleet. We turn now to Jerry Hendricks. This former Navy captain, PhD, and author of the piece in The Atlantic you heard me talking about, The Age of American Naval Dominance is Over, from my program earlier this week. Now, the unfortunate part, good news, bad news, is that Xi and Putin are meeting in Moscow this week. And 7 days ago, you published an essay that said either of those powers could shut down freedom of the seas in a moment, bring us into conflict, at which point the Navy's going to have to make some decisions. And you paint real world threats. Earlier today, Congressman Gallagher said they played a Chinese attack on Taiwan war game for 90 minutes at the GOP Congressional Caucus with your friend Admiral Montgomery providing commentary. Are you encouraged by, A, that The Atlantic wanted your article, B, 60 Minutes ran a story on sea power, and C, that the Republican caucuses are running war games?
I'm encouraged by all three of those items that you just mentioned. Obviously, as we look at Xi and Putin coming together, these are two great traditional continental powers. They're land powers that share a long border between each other. Both of those nations have always viewed the sea suspiciously because the sea is a medium for the free exchange of commerce. And the concept of freedom and the exchange of free ideas is something that they look very nervously on, which is one of the reasons why both of them have sought to control the seas and the oceans around them. Russia's been very focused on the Baltic and the Black Sea and now the Arctic over the last 50 years. China has now looked at the East China Sea and the South China Sea and essentially has laid these territorial claims as if they are internal waters. And of course, this is a threat to the very concept of the free sea, which is sort of foundational to the Western Enlightenment and to the way that the globalized system that the United States has spent 70 years building. So seeing them together makes me very nervous because they have a lot of potential power. They can do a lot of damage to the international economic system if they act together.
You know, now you anticipate the criticism in your essay in The Atlantic by that people are going to say, well, we don't have a lot of buggies and horse whips around anymore either. So going from 6,900 ships to 271 doesn't matter. But Jerry, it does matter. And would you explain to people why we are now below the critical line? I think we've kind of flatlined.
Yeah. So, Hugh, I'm going to make a slight adjustment in your numbers. So we had 6,700 at the end of World War II. You're correct. We came down to about 1,000 ships during the Eisenhower administration, and we remained steady state through about 1969. And then Vietnam sort of began to eat into the naval budget at that point in time. So we dropped down during the Ford and Carter administrations. Reagan rebuilds us to nearly 600. And then essentially after the Cold War, we declared those peace dividends and we just started cashing in. So we cut 100 ships in the first year after the end of the Cold War, and we bottomed out at 271 during the Obama administration. There were some slight incremental changes. I checked this morning. The fleet's at 296. But the point that I make here is that when you dropped below 300, that was a go signal to China. You can look at their investments. You can look at the time when they changed their strategy. That occurred in the late 1990s, early 2000s, when the U.S. Navy dropped below 300. And China and Russia, to a certain extent, made the decision that, okay, the Americans aren't paying attention to the great oceans, the global commons. Now is our time to make our move. So they began to invest. And as the 60 Minutes report made the point, you know, the Chinese Navy has tripled essentially in the last 15 years, tripled in size, and is tremendously more modern.
Now, Captain Hendricks, you also point out our capacity to build and repair has plummeted. I didn't know the word gravet. Am I pronouncing it correctly? Gravet? Is it gravet? I don't know what it is, but I know we haven't got them.
I think you're talking about graving docks there.
Yes.
And essentially those graving docks, those are the those are the golden goose. Those are the things that lay the eggs, and the eggs are these ships. And if you don't have graving docks, then you don't have ships. And
explain what they are.
Cut back on. Yeah, so a graving dock is simply a place where a ship is assembled. So it's a large industrial construction site, and obviously it has to have access to the water, because when the ship is finally ready to be launched, it's going to have to slide out in the water. But these things have to be very large. They're very, you know, they've got huge foundations. They can bear great amounts of weight. Obviously, the Ford-class aircraft carrier weighs in at 100,000 tons. So you have to have something that can hold that. You build it within it, and then you flood it, and you float the ships out at the end. During World War II, we had over 50 of these that could service ships or build ships of a length of 150 meters or greater. Today, you know, we're down to around 20, 23, with only 12 of them being certified for the Navy's use. So it's a tremendous cutback in the industrial capacity of the United States, not just to build ships, Hugh, but to repair them. And this is a point I made in the essay as well. We no longer have the capacity to repair the ships that we have. Almost a third of our submarine force is sidelined right now, waiting access to these graving docks, these repair yards, where they can be brought in and serviced. And when you got a third of your fleet on the sidelines, you're not ready for battle. And the enemy is watching.
So, Jerry Hendricks, you advocate for a Ships Act to accompany the CHIPS Act. Congressman Gallagher echoed that call for a Ships Act. What would be in it? Because a lot of Republicans are skeptical of spending money right now, given our $31 trillion debt. What would be in a Ships Act?
Well, I think we'd have to make a major investment in the industrial base, and we have to make a wise investment. We have to go back almost to the Eisenhower dispersal policy type of investment, where we began to make decisions about where we need to have additional capacity so that we could be safe in a time of war. You want to think about where you're going to be vulnerable in that time of war. So I raise in the essay that during World War II, you know, we built a lot of ships on the Mississippi River, on the Ohio River. We even built submarines on Lake Michigan and then floated them out through the Chicago River to the Mississippi and down. We need to think about building where the workers are. That's one of the major challenges that we have today, is where is your blue-collar workforce located? And then you sort of have to try to figure out a plan to go to them. We are building on the East Coast. We have some construction capacity in San Diego. We have a yard up in Bremerton, Washington, that's been sidelined because of EPA regulations. So there's four dry docks up there that we can't even access right now. We need to kind of go and build where we can right now. And that's why I think we have the Ships Act, where we have an industrial policy to make targeted investments in smaller yards in order to increase their capacity to get us ready for war.
Coming up.
This was a mistake that we made in many ways when we pulled back from sort of supporting our own shipbuilding economy.
More with Jerry Hendricks in the final segment of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Stay with us.
Tuning into the baseball game, monitoring the incoming storm, catching your favorite talk show. These are just a few of the reasons more than 80 million Americans depend on AM radio each month. And did you know AM radio is the backbone of the emergency alert system, keeping us safe in dangerous times? It's reliable, free, and public safety depends on it. Text AM to 52886 and tell Congress we need AM radio in cars. This message furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. It is pretty difficult to overstate the importance of this week's meeting between Secretary of State Blinken and General Secretary and Dictator for Life Xi Jinping. As the risk of armed conflict between the two nations becomes more evident, the question emerges. How do our military assets and our state of readiness compare to those of China? Let's pick up with more of my conversation with Captain Jerry Hendricks, PhD historian, retired Navy captain. Jerry, assume for a moment that hypersonics is all the threat that it is, plus more, and the Chinese People's Liberation Army Navy wanted to make a Pearl Harbor-like strike that was non-nuclear. They could hit our carriers, but how many different shipyards would they have to hit with hypersonics to put us, basically paralyze our ability to stay at sea?
Well, you heard the CNO say during the 60 Minutes interview that essentially we're dependent upon seven shipyards. I know where they're at, and so do the Chinese. And so the idea that they would be able to target them. Now, the most difficult shipyards to reach are the ones that are farthest from Chinese access. So obviously you think about Guam, you think about Pearl Harbor, then you come down to San Diego. Those are a little less vulnerable. Then you think about the Gulf Coast and the Atlantic. Those are less vulnerable because the Chinese have to work harder to get there. I like the idea of, you know, where we're building the frigate, which is up in Marinette, Wisconsin.
I want to close by hearing your thoughts on what Xi and Putin would be talking about.
They're talking about, one, how are they going to set up a more robust, transportation system to be able to move men and material and supplies, mostly supplies, from China to Putin right now, because he's having real difficulties with troop generation and some of his ordnance. He's starting to run out of things like 155 rounds. So can the Chinese provide him that? Also, China's looking at Putin and saying, I need more energy for my economy. I can't depend on the energy that's coming out of the Middle East. Can you give me more out of your northern energy supplies? And so Putin's starting to talk about supply lines going through the Arctic Ocean and then down around Asia and then into Chinese ports. So I think that they're having that idea of sort of building this system of military exchange, technological exchange, and energy and commercial exchange. They're sort of knitting together this alliance, which, by the way, I think is something that we've seen coming for a while. They're going to have to come together before they grow apart, and they will grow apart eventually because the Russians hate to be thought as a subservient power to China, and that's very much what they are. They are the junior partner, as Xi said.
What did we think they were doing?
Well, this was a mistake that we made in many ways. When we pulled back from sort of supporting our own shipbuilding economy, essentially that allowed others to step in. So Asian shipbuilders in Japan, South Korea, and China. China's the largest shipbuilder in the world. They are producing more ships than the other great shipbuilding countries together, combined.
Wow.
In fact, one Chinese shipyard, and there's 19 of them, one Chinese shipyard has more capacity than all American shipyards combined.
Thank you for joining us for the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com. And take a moment, please, to sign up for our podcast. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Schubin, producers David Pouchon, Ben Brigman, Michael Cook, Jacob Orduña, Tim Gantner, Adam Ramsey, and, of course, Dwayne Patterson. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for joining us for Town Hall Review.
Star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
with in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.